living a life of love is living in abundance. It's not living from scarcity or competition with other people. It's attracting good things into your life. It's having that level of, you know, magnetic desire that can help you get through difficult times. Yeah. Also, you know, harmony and universal connection. Harmony is basically love, and universal connection is that we're all, you know, we're all connected. And the more love and kindness that we put out into the universe, we make the world a better place. And, you know, hopefully some of that comes, you know, back to us.
This is Reinvent Yourself with Dr. Tara Swart-Beaver. Conversations on neuroplasticity, the science that proves every brain, even your brain, can change, no matter your mindset or stage in life. Each episode, Dr. Tara leads compelling conversations with familiar voices to explore how anyone, even you, can reinvent yourself. And now, here's Mark Steele.
Welcome to Reinvent Yourself with Dr. Tara. I'm Mark Steele, producer of the podcast. We here at the show hope your year is starting off just as you had hoped, with new opportunities and efforts toward reinvention. Last episode, I began an in-depth conversation with Dr. Tara about the practical science of neuroplasticity, digging into steps and tools that you can apply to your own life, and we spoke specifically about the subject of motivation. Today, we will delve deeper into that conversation so that this year, 2023, you can resolve to reinvent yourself. We're all very excited, so let's get started. My conversation today is with the namesake of Reinvent Yourself with Dr. Tara, and for good reason. Dr. Tara Swart-Beaver is a PhD neuroscientist and Oxford University-trained former MD. She is a best-selling and award-winning author, an executive advisor, and faculty at MIT Sloan, frequently quoted in the press. She is a globally renowned thinker and spokesperson for how to apply neuroscience to transform your life. Tara travels extensively, translating this complex science to people as it relates to their work, culture, family, and mental wellness. Dr. Tara is an expert on neuroplasticity, the science that proves every brain can change, no matter your mindset or stage in life. And I have to tell you, for all those accolades and high-mindedness and the genius that you are, you'll never meet a kinder, more intuitive person who wants to invest in the lives of those around you. Please welcome my friend, Dr. Tara Swart-Beaver. How are you this morning?
I'm good. Well, it's not morning here, obviously.
Well, of course, you know, morning for me.
Yeah.
How do you address that? How do you say good morning when it's morning for you, but evening elsewhere? Good day.
You can say good day, but what I'm really conscious of always trying to do, because I work across so many time zones, is making sure that I get it right for the other person.
Oh, yeah. Well, you just shamed me. That's exactly what I should have done. Boys, think of how selfish my thinking is, thinking about what time it is for me, but not for you. See, already neuroplasticity in action. I've learned something in minute one.
But listen, when people listen to the podcast, it's going to be all over the world in all different times, so it doesn't matter.
That's true. So maybe, you know, maybe through percentages, I'll end up being right. It's rare. Usually you're the one who's right. Well, last episode was such an extraordinary time, talking about motivation, the science of motivation as we get into this new year, and being reminded of such extraordinary conversations that you had throughout this first half of the first season of this program. Today, we're going to talk about something that people don't often connect to science, and that is because we're talking about love. And love, you know, everybody feels it at some point in their life, but they don't tend to break it down all that often. It's such a mystery. It's, you know, it's that one tangible facet of our lives that we talk about in almost a fictional or a fantastical way. We discuss love, whether it be of a person or of an ideal, as a dream or a storybook tale, even though it is one of the single most profound factors impacting our days, our decisions, our feelings, our emotions, our choices. So when we're talking about such a complex human experience as love, how on earth do we reconcile the fundamental laws and hard data of science with the transcendent experience of love? What do you mean when you talk about the science of love, Dr. Tara?
So I've got two ways I could answer that. One is that if I'm going back to fundamentals to explain anything, I always think about our evolutionary wiring. Mm. And so when we lived in the cave, we had to exist as part of a tribe to survive. And that was partly that we needed shelter and physical warmth to physically survive.
Oh, yes.
But it was also that we needed to belong and have emotional warmth to survive as well. And that's basically love. So I always like to take it back to those fundamental principles. But I mean, I am talking about love in the sense of, you know, that feeling that we, you know, we've all experienced. But I will explain it by the correlation with the bonding hormone oxytocin.
Mm.
So oxytocin is a hormone that's released through physical touch and affection. So hugging, even handshaking, or, you know, peck on the cheek, like if it's more professional, and during sex,
yes.
And also things like massage and bathing, so immersion in warm water. So that's the main hormone that's underlying love. But as you know, I do like to simplify things, but I always, with the caveat that the brain and hormones and neurotransmitters are much more complex than that. So it's not one hormone for one emotion. So when we get something that we like or love, we would get a dopamine reward in certain pathways of the brain as well. And when we get something that we want, that's operating in the opioid pathways of the brain. But I think for the rest of this conversation, we'll probably mostly talk about oxytocin when we're talking about love.
Yeah, it's so fascinating when you talk about just that chemical component of physical touch, and you think specifically pre-COVID, how when we would meet a stranger, how the human tradition is to what? To shake hands and to literally connect over a physical touch before we know that other individual on any level whatsoever. And how, when you think back, why do we have those customs? When you really break them down, they feel unusual, and then it makes perfect sense when you explain that the science of it is that is a bond. That is a chemical bond that begins in that moment and does something to our relationship with that person. It's absolutely fascinating.
Did you know, Mark, that if you, let's say you're at a conference and I was speaking and I asked everybody to get up and shake hands with the person next to them, that within about a minute, at least 75% of people in the room who've shaken hands with somebody that they haven't met before will smell their fingers.
Wow. That is fantastic. That's so interesting. I thought what you were going to say is, and I don't know if this is a component as well, because I've been to events where that happened. And I would say that 100% of the time, if I have not spoken to that stranger before shaking their hand, once I've shaken their hand in that environment, when a speaker says, turn to your left and right, shake the hand, I then begin speaking to them as if there is now suddenly a relationship that I subconsciously did that 100% of the time.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, you know, physical touch is important for the reasons that we've discussed already, but we also know who is a member of our tribe, not just through obvious things like hair color and hair texture and skin color and eye shape and eye color and stuff like that, but also through smell. I have this theory, kind of based on science, but more based on life, that for your romantic partner, you have to love their smell. So of all the senses, there could be other things that you know, aren't 100% ideal, like what you see or what you touch. But if you don't like the smell of the person, you can't be in an intimate relationship with them.
That is so interesting. And yet you look at how much of humankind that for the sake of romance attempts to change their smell. Right? Whether it be through colognes and perfumes, or whether it be through hand creams, or whether it be through, you know, cleaning up before a first date, that we try to mask that natural scent. That olfactory component is so fascinating. I want to go back a little bit to what is it about that moment? Let's go back to the conference. Yeah. We've just shaken the hand of a stranger and 75% of us go to smell our fingers. What's that about? I mean, obviously that's not about romance. What is the urge and the tendency to take that step mean? What's going on in our brain?
Yeah, so it's basically what I said before about like pheromones and how you know somebody's in your tribe, and smell is the most emotive sense because the olfactory nerve and olfactory bulb go from your nose directly to your limbic system, which is like the emotional system of the brain.
Wow.
So it is kind of, you know, it's another way of recognizing people. And, you know, animals do it all the time. That's you know, how animals recognize each other. So
my dog won't stop doing it to me. Every moment.
It's basically a kind of, you know, it's a primal behavior. And I remember once watching this nature documentary about tigers, and male tigers don't stay with their family and they will kill any tiger cubs that they come across. And there was this awful scene where there were like two boy tiger cubs and a girl tiger cub, and the girl wanders off and she goes into the territory close to her father. And I thought we were going to see something horrible, but he just completely ignored her because he won't kill his own. And I was like, but how did he know? And I think it is to do with the stripes, but it would also be to do with smell.
Well, we were taught growing up, and I never knew if this was an old wives' tale, to never pick up a baby bird that's fallen from its nest, because if the mother smells that a human has touched the bird, the mother will reject the bird. Mm. And I never knew, is that actual scientific fact, or is that something that our parents taught us so we won't get bird flu, right?
Well, I was taught that too, so I don't know the answer to that.
Well, we're going to start today. We're going to support this conversation as we dive deeper. We're going to hear a quote real quick from Bruce Lipton during his interview. So this is a very high-minded scientist, Dr. Bruce Lipton. And so if you'd think anyone had a separation of the metaphysical from the physical and from an idea like love from the scientific, it would be him. But here's what he had to say about love after all of his scientific pursuits.
Consciousness is going to elevate us. Not our genes. And we want to go somewhere, then we have to say, then what's going on with my consciousness that I'm not manifesting this? And then once you know, then you have an opportunity to rewrite. Hola, I did it myself.
Yeah.
And I never believed in it, but boy, I want to tell you, love is the most powerful force on this planet. Mm. Love is the origin of harmony.
Mm. And I remember you saying in that episode how much you agreed with that statement. And I mean, certainly I agree with it as well. And it's so fascinating to hear such high-minded science brains talk about love in such a fashion. Most of our listeners are going to agree with the fact that love is such a complicated reality, because first you're talking about the science of attraction, but then you're talking about something that needs to be sustained, right? And invested in and developed over time. I guess let's go back a little bit. You talked a lot about that initial attraction. You talked about pheromones and the chemical component. How do we explain connection to that singular individual, right? I mean, as opposed to, we know they're part of our tribe, we know that we're of one mind and of one accord. What is it that draws us to the specific lone individual, to be drawn to them and somehow to want to invest in many times a lifetime of the discipline of love?
So I'm going to be a real scientist here, I'm afraid.
I love that.
Even though, you know, I don't want this episode to only be about romantic love. I actually really want the message to be, that living a life motivated by love.
Absolutely.
Love for yourself, love, for everyone.
Yes, absolutely.
Giving and receiving it. Mm-hmm. But in terms of that romantic partner, I'm afraid the answer is reproduction. So
interesting.
In the cave, we didn't live in unit families. We lived in larger kind of communal families, which some cultures still do. And the men hunted and gathered and lived quite nomadically. So sometimes they would leave the cave and be gone for so long that either they wouldn't return and they would just set up a new cave or join another tribe, like a similar tribe.
Yes.
Or they would go away for a long time. And so to make sure that the alpha male's genes would be reproduced, he would impregnate 4 or 5 women before he left.
Mm.
And that's because obviously in those days there was much more miscarriages and stillbirths and things like that. Or even if the baby was born, it could die of hypothermia, or it could, be taken by a wolf or something like that. So, impregnating 4 or 5 women before leaving would ensure that at least one of them of the alpha male's genes would survive. And, another interesting thing that I sometimes speak about is the fact that women who live together or work closely together synchronize their menstrual cycles within 2 months.
Wow.
And that's related to what I've just said. So to be able to impregnate 4 or 5 women at the same time, they'd have to be fertile at the same time.
Right.
And don't you think it's amazing that that's the reason that, you know, that happens is because of cave times, and it still happens to like modern working women today.
Oh, it makes perfect sense. You know, but then you also think about the way people, individuals are drawn to one another when it has nothing to do with romance or reproduction. You think of the way what's been called many times, far too specifically, brotherly love. But when you feel that tether almost instantly with someone else, and yet it's not romantic, but there's certainly something chemical about the draw to specific friends, specific soulmates who are going to walk through life with you without it ever turning into romantic partner or procreation. Is that a different chemical that, and again, I want to get into living a life of love, but just out of curiosity, starting here, I think is fascinating.
Mm. So that's oxytocin as well.
Yes.
Because it's bonding. It's not just sexual.
Right.
You bond, it's the same bond that you have with your children.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the hormone that's, you know, more to do with love in that broader sense of the term. I mean, in sexual attraction, another thing that I think is super fascinating is that when women have sex, they always release oxytocin, and that makes them bond to the man that they're having sex with. For men, if there's no love there, then they'll only release testosterone.
Wow.
When they're having sex. But if they love the woman, then it's testosterone and oxytocin.
That is fantastic. How interesting. It's a completely different experience.
So another thing about love and men is that when a man becomes a father for the first time, his testosterone levels drop, so that instead of feeling competitive, the balance of testosterone and oxytocin changes so that he bonds with the baby.
Yeah.
And if the baby sleeps in the same room as the parents, then the father's testosterone levels drop even more. And when I told that to my hedge fund clients, they basically wanted their babies out of their bedroom.
Oh,
because
my God.
But I think it's really interesting how we've evolved, because, you know, most modern cultures do require that, you know, we live in unit families and the man doesn't just impregnate the woman and leave.
Right.
So over time, you know, but it's taken millennia, the brain has rearranged, the brain of a father has rewired itself to have that oxytocin boost at the time of birth. You know, obviously oxytocin also underlies childbirth and breastfeeding. And so the mother gets, you know, a huge love bubble at that time, less obvious with the father, but you know, in recent years, we've seen the neuroplasticity of the paternal brain changing much more than we thought before.
Well, talk about reinventing yourself. I mean, really, that's a perfect example where man was designed one way for this urge to be to procreate. And now in modern society, more and more, thank God, fathers are saying, I want to be invested. I want to be a good husband, a great father. I want to be disciplined, not just feel great about it or just have testosterone stirred. I want to invest in love in all these relationships, even when I don't feel it. And that, what you're really saying, took a pivot even from the science, took a pivot of discipline, right? To reinvent ourselves, to rewire our brains towards the investment, the selfless side of the act of love.
Mm. Yeah, I love that.
And of course, you know, being a man in modern America and the modern world, that is the challenge. The challenge is to, when you don't feel love the most, when the chemicals aren't at their highest point, to invest, to be disciplined in love, which we know is a verb more than anything else.
Mm.
Well, as we talk about the investment of love, one of our guests over the past course of this season, Tamara Mellon, said something really insightful about doing what we love. And she's talking about in the context of her work, but it actually will apply much further than that into our lives. Mm. So let's hear what she had to say.
Well, the ultimate goal, I guess, in life is if you do what you're passionate about, the rest follows, the money follows, because you're in flow.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Of creating what you love, so the rest will follow, rather than that feeling of that struggle right? Mm. Because you've got to do this, you know, mm-hmm. and it's almost like that feeling of resistance. Like I'm doing this to earn some money, but I have that feeling of resistance that I don't want to do it. I mean, obviously, that's not always realistic, but when you're doing what you're passionate about and you have that sense of flow, it's the best feeling in the world.
I think this is the topic that I hear more in daily conversation and discussion from the people in my circle. And that is, how do you drum up the love and the passion for your days, for the rigmarole of your work and your family life, if it's not there in feeling, if you're not getting the dopamine kicks? How do you change your brain so that you have a passion for your days and for what you do and your activities and the things that you must be disciplined about? Is there a science behind that, Dr. Tara?
So let's just start by re-emphasizing that obviously not everybody is lucky enough to, you know, have a job or daily activities that they love.
Right.
And this kind of goes back a little bit to our previous conversation, which is, you know, that's why there can become a lack of motivation.
Yes.
There's actually some science that shows that presenteeism costs businesses twice as much as absenteeism. So if you're stressed, if you've lost motivation, if you've fallen out with coworkers, or you just don't love what you're doing, then because you still, you know, need the money to put food on the table, you'll come to work and you'll sit there, but the blood flow is in your survival centers. It's called, you know, basically you go into survival mode. You need to keep your job, but you don't love what you're doing. So all of the higher, you know, centers and the ability to think flexibly, creatively, solve complex problems, the blood flow goes away from that. And the balance of cortisol and oxytocin changes so that, you know, you've got basically more stress flowing through your brain rather than love and trust and joy and excitement flourishing through your brain. Presenteeism is basically coming into work, sitting at the desk all day, trying to look like you're doing something, but, you know, not really over, you know, achieving or being creative, or, you know, coming up with new ideas. And that waste of time is really bad for businesses and it's really bad for people. But what can you do about it? The answer that comes from science is that if you have a purpose that transcends yourself, that is the happiest state that you can be in.
Right.
So it may be, for a lot of people, I'm sure, that the day job isn't, you know, their passion.
Right.
But if you can find something else in your life that's really important to you, that's not just to pay the bills, then you can kind of mitigate the issues that you might have because you've got a job that you don't love.
That is so insightful and fascinating, that presenteeism is worse. It's more damaging than absenteeism. That you being in your home, in your place of work, in your relationships, you being present there but not fully there is worse than you being gone completely. And, you know, I would back this into a philosophy that I've always had, which is unhappiness, not being fulfilled in a career path or in a marriage, has more to do with not feeling valuable to it. And that's not necessarily something that others have put on you. And yet we go back to what we discussed last week, that it is something many people put on themselves. That, you know, I've been a boss of creative companies many times, and I've seen those employees who are sitting at their desk and they don't feel like they can do anything effective. And therefore they replace productivity with bad attitudes and lack of progress. And it all stems from the fact that they don't believe they are bringing anything of value to what's going on. And again, we talk about reinventing ourselves. We talk about changing the narrative. And if you're wanting to find happiness, well, maybe it's not about you trying to discover happiness as much as maybe it's about something else. You reassessing who you are and what you bring to the table in order to bring value can bring those type of things. And I would translate to that. I'm in a creative business and you are as well, Tara. And, you know, I've been in that place that you have where sometimes you have to pay the bills through that day job. I always tell other writers, I go, find a time at the end of the day to bring your energy up, even if it's just writing a page, even if it's just writing two pages, so that you feel that you have accomplished something in the day that only you can bring to the world. And as I've watched writers do that slowly, even just a page a day, creating something, crafting something, bringing something fresh into the world has lifted their spirits and brought them to a place of joy, even in the categories of life, work, home, marriage, where maybe they didn't have joy before.
Yeah. And maybe we should actually say that oxytocin underlies love, trust, joy, and excitement. Mm. So we decided today to speak about love, but we're really, if we're talking about oxytocin, we're talking about all four of those things. And so I think this is where gratitude comes in as well,
because
if there is a day where maybe you can't write those two pages for whatever reason, lack of time or just, you know, no ideas coming into your head, then just say 10 things you're grateful for, because that will boost your oxytocin too and it'll put you into a more, you know, joyful and loving state.
And I know several couples who in their marriage, when they were hitting rough spots, when they took that step and at the end of each day, even privately, even if they didn't express it to their significant other, if they took the time to write down 3 things, 5 things that they're grateful for about that companion, about that significant other, that over time it began to change their attitude and change their heart because they were no longer only choosing to look at the frustrations.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're saying that there's a chemical scientific component to that, that it's not just something a marriage therapist would say to do that's good homework. It's actually changing the makeup of your body a little bit every time you do that, right? By producing chemicals.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think I can say this enough, but every piece of psychological work that you do is correlated to hormones and neurotransmitters and synapses changing in your brain. You know, this is a bit more about motivation, but that's why when, you know, the going gets tough, let's say in a relationship or on a work project or something, that understanding that it's physically hard work when you're thinking about the work project or you're having doubts about the relationship, that's, you know, there's physical stuff going on in your brain when that's going on for you psychologically.
You know, we're doing this show in January because, you know, this is when people are kind of trying to make a pivot in their life. But another thing about winter it really tends to be a time of what the film community calls ennui, of the blahs, of many people feeling kind of at their low point emotionally. And really we're talking about chemically and how that impacts everything from the state of their marriage, the state of their work life, feeling unloved. And, you know, these tools that you are communicating are so pivotal because I think a lot of people look at something like therapy or look at something like speaking out other truths and they think, well, that's just for optimists. That's just for certain kind of people who buy into this. And the beauty of what you bring to the table, Dr. Tara, is that you're communicating these aren't just positive habits. These are hormone creating activities, right? They're actually doing something tangible and physical to your scientific makeup that can tangibly pull you out of those low places by creating the very parts of our system that we need to be lifted out of depression, ennui, the blahs, however you want to state it. So these are more than suggestions that are positive. These are tangible steps that are effective and proven.
Yeah. And on that note, I would add that there are, you know, physical things that you might have to do as well. Like you were talking about this time of year in winter in the Northern Hemisphere, particularly. And I myself get a bit of seasonal affective disorder, and affect is mood.
Yes.
And the mood hormone is serotonin. So basically, when you don't get enough sunlight, the receptor sensitivity to serotonin can go down. So for me, you know, what was like a complete game changer was understanding that I need to supplement with vitamin D. So to provide the building blocks to make the hormone that's going to keep my mood in the normal range.
So good. So what are some habits we really need to be watching for, especially at this time of year? Sleep, you always talk about sleep. You talk about making sure we're hydrated. Are there specific vitamins, specific nutrients that we should be especially focused on in these types of times of year when we're not getting as much sunlight?
Yeah. So sleep, you know, yes, I am always talking about getting enough sleep, but if you're depressed, you can actually oversleep. So I would say this time of year, you need to be careful that you're not doing that. A few years ago, I was really like, I was literally like a little bear in hibernation. I just wanted to sleep and eat all the time. you know, around that sort of October, November time. But I prevented myself from doing that because I knew that it wasn't good. And actually, if you sleep for more than, so the ideal sleep length is 8 hours and 15 minutes. And more than that can itself be depressogenic.
Wow.
So that means it can cause depression. Yes, of course, sleep is really important. And I, you know, want everybody to get good quality, sufficient length of sleep. But at this time of year, watch out for oversleeping. You also, your brain will crave carbohydrates to try to make the serotonin. So you can find that you're doing a lot of comfort eating. And there was one year again when I realized I really need to up my protein and not like keep eating loads of carbohydrates. Yes. And that helped
I'll make
too.
Myself happy with pasta.
Exactly.
And congruent naps. Pasta then nap. Pasta then nap.
And if you think, basically, if you're sleeping and eating carbohydrates all the time, you're going to put on weight and that could also affect your mood.
Definitely.
So you really don't want to be doing that. Making sure that you're outside during the peak sunlight hours.
Very good.
But even then, you know, you need to be exposing most of your limbs and part of your torso to actually get enough vitamin D through your skin. So that's the big one to supplement. I now have an annual reminder for October 1st or whenever the clocks change to start taking that. So I take a multivitamin throughout the year. I'm the chief science officer at Heights, which is a brain care supplement that's got, you know, all those, the B complex and D and everything in it. But even then I have to add in extra vitamin D from October.
Very smart. And that's a great idea. You know, that's another important point, knowing yourself, knowing your rhythms, knowing, you know, you have assessed your life, you know that come October 1st or whenever the time changes that there's going to be a struggle. Historically, there's been a struggle. Mm-hmm. So you preemptively do something about it. You set a calendar message for yourself to remind yourself what you need to counterbalance the deficit. And we even talked about this last week, taking the time to face those stressful decisions and methods and ways that you can prepare yourself for the best version of yourself. Before we go to the break, we're going to listen to one more clip here. Austin John Winkler talked a great deal about how he's gotten to do, quote unquote, what he loves for a living his entire life. But that didn't change the fact that for a season, it was nothing more than hell for him. And he had to turn a corner and grow to love it again. This is very much what we're talking about in regard to our lives. And let's hear what Austin had to say.
Yeah, so I'm working on a whole tray of different types of music and projects now. And, you know, moving forward, you know, I don't necessarily think the process is all that different. I think it's just gotten back to the, you know, original love that I have for doing what I do,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's, I lost it for such a long time. I feel like I there were 6 years that it was just, I hated everything.
Mm.
You know, the fact that, you know, with Super Jaded and having that moment, like I had described in the bed and letting go of all that stuff, has just opened the possibility and made me believe in myself in a whole different way that I didn't before. Working with people and building relationships that are solid and in the industry and not being fickle and not, you know, isolating myself. That's, mm-hmm. I mean, that's something that I still do and something that I will have to work on,
mm-hmm.
you know. But all these, you know, I got enough songs to put out a record. I mean, I'm just kind of getting my feet back wet. Like, you know, I'm very, very excited.
Yeah.
What Austin's talking about here, I think, is of extreme value for us to discuss because this is where many, many people hit a low point. And that is in whatever category of their life they have discovered something they love, whether it be with the spouse, with family, whether it be in extracurricular activity, whether it be in the workplace, where they've found the thing that excites them, there still comes a season where even that loses its luster. And that mm-hmm. is when most grown men hit that low point that many will call a midlife crisis, when their life mm-hmm. isn't what they thought it was supposed to be or going to be. And I don't know if there's what the chemical component is to that season of life to have that discovery of wow, the thing that I thought would be worth holding on to, I'm struggling to see the value in continuing to hold on to it. The feelings of love are waning. Why does that happen? And what can we do to stir ourselves out of that when the very thing we most wanted or thought we most wanted becomes blasé and everyday and no longer excites us and produces that chemical?
So I think what Austin said there was a really important reminder that you can fall out of love with things, yes, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's the end, and you can fall back in love with, you know, your job, music, your partner, whatever. And that he talked about his love of music and believing in himself again, which is self-love, and connecting with others and not isolating himself, which is love, you know, in the community. So I guess I'm just trying to say there that there's, you know, all these different types of love, and the fact that over a lifetime, the levels of love that you have for those things will go up and down. I mean, I think what you're getting at is that, you know, over a very long marriage, there can be those like periods where it feels like the love isn't there. And do you stay or do you go? And the classic midlife crisis, I think, is also because, you know, midlife means that you know that you're in the second half of your life and that your life is going to end at some point.
Right.
And, you know, if you're also becoming aware that your testosterone levels are dropping, then you get the classic, you know, run off with somebody 20 years younger,
right,
kind of make yourself feel young again and try to get that excitement. Again, excitement is oxytocin. And, you know, if we're talking testosterone levels, then a new relationship can increase that. And I think, you know, people will make their choices on that kind of thing for different reasons. And I believe that if you make a choice and you make it work, that that's okay, as long as you don't, you know, hurt other people. But if you did want, you know, to maintain, sustain longevity in a relationship, then I think you just have to accept that there are periods where it doesn't feel like there's a lot of love between you, but that it can and will come back, and that you might just have to get through that period with a lot of empathy and understanding and self-care and maybe professional help. But I think as people get older, I mean, you know, when you're sort of 16, if you have an argument with your boyfriend, then that's it, you've broken up. But when you're older, you kind of, you know, you understand that there are ups and downs, and you make a decision of whether you want that, you know, to have longevity, and then you work your way through those things.
Well, and I think it's important as well for especially men of a certain age to understand the science of it, that where they may instantly go wide and when they hit that moment think, oh, my life is not at all what I thought it should have been. Instead, break it down to the science of, you know what, I'm actually chasing a very specific chemical feeling that I don't currently have. That's what I'm chasing here. And that with that understanding of it, breaking down to the actual physicality of it, it can give us perspective of, you know, this same job, relationship, effort that I've invested so much in. Why blow that investment if it's simply about doing the work to reinvigorate that excitement again, to reinvigorate those chemicals kicking off? And, you know, I know that for me, that helps. Certainly just simply knowing that it is the physicality of your body chasing a chemical, chasing a feeling that you felt when you were young, and desperately wanting to believe that that's not the end of that feeling, but that there are other ways that you can have that feeling again. And so I think that's very valuable, especially for the men in the audience to have heard. Tara?
Mark, when you listen back to this podcast, you're going to become aware of how many times you said men of a certain age.
So well, I am like a man of a certain age.
I know. I feel like you're trying to get a free therapy session. So I'll just give you a quick tip before we go into the break, right, which is the best way to increase your testosterone levels is to do weight-bearing exercise followed by eating cabbage, because there's a particular chemical compound in cabbage that helps to build testosterone levels.
You hear that, men? Go fight a bear, then eat a cabbage. All right, we'll be right back. You're listening to Reinvent Yourself with Dr. Tara. We'll be back after this.
Reinvent Yourself with Dr. Tara is proud to be supported by MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, and their executive education programs. MIT, join us in building a better world.
This is Dr. Tara, and I've been faculty at MIT Sloan since 2014. I absolutely adore the MIT Sloan community and the opportunities we provide for lifelong learning and continual self-improvement. MIT Sloan Executive Education has a myriad of amazing learning opportunities, including my very own six-week online course, Neuroscience for Business, a program designed for leaders. MIT Executive Education is truly a great companion to our podcast, because if you really want to reinvent yourself, MIT will help you start your journey today.
For more information on MIT Executive Education, including details on Dr. Tara's six-week course, Neuroscience for Business, simply visit executive.mit.edu today. That's executive.mit.edu. An extraordinary first step toward reinventing yourself. And now, back to the conversation.
Welcome back to Reinvent Yourself with Dr. Tara. Again, I want to thank producer Nadir Tavangar for the lovely voiceover work this episode, proving once again where I am unneeded. See that midlife crisis that we talk about? So we were talking a little bit offline. Go ahead, Tara.
You are so loved and needed and wanted by all of our colleagues that it's just a joke that you said that.
Well, it was a joke. I don't actually question it. I would be worried about how loved I was if I wasn't so utterly lovable. But speaking to that end, we were talking about how hard it is to, in this day and age, live a life of love. You know, we've talked specifically about the chemistry of romance, if you will, of commitment, of feeling like you've lost that moxie, if you will, not only for romance, but for work. But let's talk about the harder discipline, about living a life of love, what it does to us. For others. What do you mean when you talk about living a life of love, Dr. Tara?
Well, I'm going to relate it a little bit to some of the principles that I wrote about in the source, which are abundance, manifestation, magnetic desire, patience, harmony, and universal connection. To me, living a life of love is living in abundance. It's not living from scarcity or competition with other people. It's attracting good things into your life. It's having that level of, magnetic desire that can help you get through difficult times.
Yes, that is so good.
Also, harmony and universal connection. Harmony is basically love, and universal connection is that we're all, we're all connected, and that the more like love and kindness that we put out into the universe, we make the world a better place. And, hopefully some of that comes back, back to us.
You're talking very specifically about concepts that a lot of people would say, is that a choice or am I built one way or the other? Some people feel like they're built negative, right? Now, of course, we know that that's not true. People aren't only one way or the other. So when you talk about these different facets, how would the everyman change their life to be about those different components that equal a life of love?
So I said in the last episode that reinvent yourself isn't that there's something wrong with you. It's about a continual evolution and always, trying to become your highest self. And it's interesting to me that not just Dr. Bruce Lipton, but Deepak Chopra and Daniel Siegel, who they're all icons for me. They've all moved along that spectrum from being about science and medicine to being about love. And I remember quite a few years ago, maybe almost a decade ago, hearing somebody, it was actually a model, but she'd obviously done spiritual work, saying love is all there is. And that really kind of stuck in my brain. And over the years, I've tried to understand what that means, maybe in a scientific way, but never quite got it. And so I think there's a point in someone's life where they have a spiritual evolution. And then you have to feel that, you can't explain that by science. Right. And logically try to make yourself believe that it's true. You really have to feel love is all there is, that, so it's a neuroplasticity journey. And more recently, I've been on the journey, but very recently, I've just been saying, I am pure love all the time.
Good.
And it's amazing, like what magical things happen when you do that. So today I went shopping. And I saw a pair of children's pajamas in a shop window that had love written on the top. And then I saw a handbag in the window of a shop that had love embroidered onto it. And I thought, okay, if there's a third sign, then, this is definitely a message that I'm on that right journey of living my life motivated by love. And I walked into another shop and the music that was playing, I had to stop and make sure I was hearing properly. Was the lyrics were, I am made of love.
Wow.
And I actually got tears in my eyes because I've been working so hard on this, and it just literally felt like the universe sent me a sign that, you know, there's so much love around. And
well, if you want a fourth sign, I'm wearing those children's pajamas right now. But isn't a big part of that that you're noticing those signs, that you're intentional about looking for those signs? Mm. I think that happens. I think that is available to the world at large to notice what commonalities, what positive commonalities are being spoken into their life. But we don't pause. We don't reflect. We don't notice.
I mean, another thing that I've really noticed is like how much my friends and family want me to know that they love me, you know, and say it to me all the time. And, you know, I'm always sending people hearts and, you know, I'm a big like hugger and everything. Yes. So just again, noticing how many times someone says to me, I love you, like you're loved, like kind of, you know, always know that I'm thinking of you and stuff like that. It's incredible. I mean, obviously I've chosen my tribe and my community again, quite intentionally, but you know, it's one of those things like, there's no limit on how much love you can give. And the more you give it, the more oxytocin flourishes through your brain, the better your brain works, the more, you know, warm and trusting you feel.
Well, and
why would you not want to do that? You know, why would you? Okay, I understand that some people might say it's not a choice, but you can evolve that way. And if you can, wouldn't your life just be so much nicer if you were, you know, giving out love and really able to receive it? I mean, I remember probably about 6 years ago, my husband saying to me, I love you unconditionally. And I said, don't say that because there's no such thing as that. And that's because I'd been previously divorced. But, you know, now I completely believe and know and receive that that is a thing.
Well, and you've said it so beautifully. You know, you've said that it's a choice, but I really want our listeners to absorb this. You know, the truth is we all need love, not just want love. We chemically, we scientifically need to be loved. And yet it is the one thing we cannot control, how much or how well we are loved. All we can control is the love we give. And yet when we do give that love, we're doing two things. We are receiving by giving. We're getting a chemical component that the act of giving love actually delivers something positive back to us. And we are making an investment in the love that we need, so that we're actually gleaning on a physical, tangible level, oxytocin, and we're gleaning on a spiritual level, investment in the love that we need back in return. And that's why the choice to live our lives from a place of love is so impactful, because it really, it reaches out with what others need before it brings it back right on us.
Yeah, and I thought you were going to say something slightly different. I love what you said, but I was thinking basically, if I live in that way, then I'm increasing my oxytocin levels, and by demonstrating my love to whoever it is, I'm increasing their oxytocin levels too.
Yeah, that is the gift. That is, yeah, I guess my comment did sound a little bit more selfish. It was intended to, in the sense of it is placing that idea of what does come back to us as we give. But then there is the exponential joy and gratifying nature of what our gift of love does for others. We talk about that winter ennui of feeling like I'm not bringing anything of value to this fill in the blank job, career path, marriage, friendship, whatever it is. When we actively give love, we reap those benefits. We see the value we bring to the world all at the same time.
And I remember my friend Kelly Rutherford, the actress, saying to her once, there's somebody in my life at the moment who, you know, just is really against me and very negative about me. And, you know, what should I do? And she said, think of 20 things you love about that person. And I did not know if I would be able to come up with 20 things, but I did. And I felt so amazing afterwards.
It's powerful.
And yeah, that's an amazing exercise that our listeners could do if they need to.
In many ways, it's the same sentiment of making a, and hear me when I say this, of making a vision board for your life. When you're creating those 20 things I love about this person, you're steering the narrative of the way you see the positive future of this person, the positive future of this mm-hmm. relationship. You're giving yourself a goal based on evidence to change the situation of the poisonous relationship into a flourishing relationship.
To be honest, I would say with this example, it's not somebody that I have a relationship with or will have a relationship with, but it's about me not having high levels of cortisol because I'm stressed out by what they're saying and
so
doing.
Good.
And me moving my brain from cortisol to oxytocin.
That's outstanding. Well, earlier this year, you also spoke with Chanel Haynes, and I mean this season of the podcast, actress Chanel Haynes, who, you know, as she went further into her life and career, she really wanted to change things, and she knew very, very specifically what she wanted to do. So she made that choice of living a life of love, but was very specific in her trajectory of what she wanted out of it. Let's hear what she had to say.
We desired something so specific. And I find the more detail, the more specific you are about your desires, the more that the entire universe and all that God has created can answer you. Mm-hmm. But when you're vague, just like in an interview, if you're vague, I don't know what you want. And so I can't give you what you want because it's too vague. And your intentions and your desires, it's the same thing with the whole universe. If you say, oh, well, I want to marry a man. Okay. That's all you're going to give me? Like, can you be more specific? Mm-hmm. And I think people are afraid to be specific for fear of being disappointed.
Yeah, I agree.
And fear and love cannot coexist. They can't live in the same space. So you either you're making choices and decisions from a place of fear, or you're making them from a place of love and knowing and boldness. You have to be bold about it.
I want to re-quote her right here. Fear and love cannot coexist. They can't live in the same place. So you either have to make choices and decisions from a place of fear, or you're making them from a place of love and knowing and boldness. And I thought that was a profound
Amazing.
Statement about the choice to live a life of love. Not only love, but the specificity of love, the boldness of love, the I will not let fear be louder in my ear than love.
I just got goosebumps listening to that again. But I remember that the moment, you know, we were recording that was a pivotal moment for me.
Yes.
Because I hadn't quite put together until she said fear and love cannot coexist, that, you know, how the balance of cortisol and oxytocin affect the blood flow around
That's
the
right.
brain and where the blood flow goes to, and, you know, whether you have a scarcity mindset or an abundant mindset because of that.
Well, and, you know, you can apply this to whatever it is in your life that you're trying to, let's take it back to the conversation of what if we have lost that passion, that chemical love in a relationship, to a job, to a calling, to a path, to a friendship, whatever it is, what do we do about it? Well, what is the opposite of love? It really is fear. The question is, can we look at our lives honestly and say, well, how much of this falling out of love is really about fear? I'm asking myself the desperate questions of, well, what am I going to become? Will it ever feel like it did before? Will I die this way? Will I never be able to accomplish what I accomplished before? Will I never be of value? And the problem with fear is that it is very rarely accurate. It may have components of truth, but it's always taking those small nuggets wide into false directions. Fear is always going to steer us because of us being afraid that the worst version of what could happen will happen. And love carries us through hope to the hope that the best that could happen should happen. And it is a mindset, a chemical influence mindset that really does impact our choices in those moments, does it not?
I'm so glad you used the word hope, because we haven't said that yet. But, and you know, I always say neuroplasticity is hope, because it's the fact that, you know, you can change and you can become a better version of yourself. And even when you were saying, is it ever going to be like it was again? I was thinking it can be better.
But again, fear tells us, no, you've experienced the best that you're going to experience it, so you better get out. You know, and again, it is, I think, just by asking ourselves those questions, just by identifying fear and breaking it down to what it's attempting to tell you, starts to bring clarity of, oh, wait a second. What I'm reacting to here is not tangible. It's not factual. It's worry. It's stress. It's worst case scenario. It's my mind extrapolating a chemical and making much, much more of it because I'm not picking it apart and willing to explore the positives.
I've got a few little tips and tricks to do when people are feeling like that. So one of them is just to journal, what would I do if I wasn't afraid?
That's so good.
That's a really good one. And then I don't know why I've picked this exercise, but it just came to my mind now. Well, because it's to do with fear of the future. So it's an exercise that I do when I stand in a room where I've got, you know, space to take seven quite big steps. And I stand and I face myself. I imagine myself in 7 years' time standing at the other end of the room. And I ask myself a question. And then I take the seven steps to the other end of the room and I turn around and I say, okay, this is how old I am because I'm Tara in the future. And I reply to Tara in the present and tell her what's going to happen.
That is a very, very good exercise. Again, talk about the discipline of hope. Pushing yourself into an environment, to a scenario where you're required to think through, what do I want to be the answer to that question? How would I counsel myself with perspective? And really, that's what you're talking about when you're saying the me 7 years from now. You're talking about the U2 has a great song that they wrote about a friend who had committed suicide called Stuck in a Moment You Can't Get Out Of. And it's all about how many of our decisions are rooted in the fact that at the moment, we think it will never get better, but it always does. And we just have to get perspective and pull ourselves out of that low moment, out of those low chemical moments, out of those lack of perspective, dark spaces. And that is what the discipline of living a life of love will help us be able to maneuver those seasons, those moments, those questions in the pivotal decisions and pivotal relationships.
Yeah, and I was just thinking most people have probably heard of the five love languages, but in terms of like reciprocity, you know, I wanted to bring this up again, is that, have you heard of them, Mark?
Oh yes, very much.
Yeah. So just for people who haven't, they are quality time together, words of affirmation, acts of service, physical affection, and gifts. And so it's quite easy for us, you know, in a romantic relationship to understand the order of importance of those for myself. And the tendency is to give the versions of that that you would like to receive. But what's really important in a loving relationship is that you work out what the order of importance is for the other person. Yes. And do the things that they want to receive rather than the things that you would want to receive.
It took me a long time to figure that out. My gift, I'm sure you would know this, mine is words of encouragement. My wife's is acts of service. And again, for the first few years of our marriage, I was just talking up all this positivity. And she's like, great, when are you going to take out the trash? You know, so, but you learn over time. That's precisely right. And what's beautiful about you mentioning that is it really does relate to living a life of love in whole, which we talked about this when you interviewed me and we were talking about parenting. It's the idea that in real love, living a life of love is as simple as this, and yet is as complicated as this. Instead of expecting the world to climb up to me and figure me out, I get on the floor with the world and I figure them out and I love accordingly. That's living the life of love through parenting, with your spouse, in your occupation, in your friendships, that it's you investing and investigating in those to whom you want to deliver love.
I love that. And you are so good at that. I mean, it's been so many times I've either cried or confided in you. And, you know, I think the last time I told you something, you said, we're your family and we love you. And, you know, just hearing that, like, from someone when you're struggling, it changes everything. And so, yeah, I think words of affirmation are what is one that I need as well. So we're a good combination. I'm not as good at doing it, but I'm also acts of service as my tough.
Well, that means a lot that you would say that, Tara, because I thought you were crying at my jokes. But
they are.
They are.
Bad
they do tend
the
to be. They steer that way. They're not necessarily a love language. Well, you know, many of our guests have expressed great love for you, Tara. And you know, what's interesting is that you say that words of affirmation are not your gift, and yet you have so much insight and are always so disciplined to speak it out when you know it's true. You have a gut instinct in you when you know the thing in your mind is going to change someone's life, and you're quick to speak it out. As a matter of fact, before we close today, I just want us to hear a few clips from the podcast over this first season, the first half of the first season, where we hear just what an impact you have on our guests. Listen to this.
I hope your listeners got a deeper side of you, knowing you like I do as a dear friend.
But I'm also really glad. I feel like people will have got to know you in the way, you know, I love you, how like funny and charming and like honest you are and stuff. So
this is awesome.
This is awesome. Thank you for being my guest on the podcast.
Thank you. And I love you so much.
I love you too.
Yeah, you can sign up for unstressable.com and on www.unstressable.com. And of course, the listeners of this podcast and Tara, you can use the code WeLoveTara for 2 months totally free.
Anyone who loves Tara deserves a 2 month free. I agree.
That. If you don't love Tara, you can't use the code.
That's amazing. Thank you.
Exactly. Don't lie. Don't come to the community if you don't love Tara. Yeah.
We'll know as well. I can see who uses what codes.
Yeah.
thank you.
The reason I play these clips is because I want our audience to hear what we are saying in action. Whether you believe it's your gifting or not, when you are taking an active role in living a life of love, when you're getting on the floor with the people around you and investing in them, understanding them, speaking life and love into them, you cannot help but have it be reciprocated in the ways that you need it. It is one of the most beautiful backwards forces in the world. We cannot control the love we receive, even though we need it more than anything else. We can only control the love we give. And when we make that our priority and our intention, we receive all that we need in return.
Yeah. It's really made me laugh listening to those again. But, you know, yeah, it makes you feel good, obviously.
Well, Dr. Tara, this has been an extraordinary month for me. You know, usually I'm just on the sidelines listening to the conversations and then, you know, having discussions with you on what should stay in the show and what should not. But it was so special for me when you asked if I would actually conduct these interviews with you over the month of January, a very exciting time. And I know our listeners love this deeper dive into the nuances of the science. And I just appreciate how you've gotten very vulnerable. You've gotten very personal in these two episodes. I know we'll do more of this type of discussion later. But of course, next episode, we're going to get back into the conversations with interesting people who have a neuroplasticity mindset. So your insight and your know-how have certainly inspired us all to seek transformation, but more importantly, just to see that it is completely possible. So I want to give you the chance, which you never get on the show, to steer our listeners towards your social media channels. What should they be looking out for? And where can they plug into you if they want to make sure they are always getting updated on what's coming up next on Reinvent Yourself with Dr. Tara?
Oh, thank you. The best place to find me and where I'm the most communicative is Instagram, where I'm at Dr. Tara Swart. I do also post on Twitter at Tara Swart. And in my Instagram bio, there's a link tree that has links to the podcast and the music and the online course at MIT and some other things that I've done. I'm sure you're probably going to say this, but our podcast is available on Apple, Spotify, Amazon, Google, wherever you listen to podcasts.
That's right. Anywhere.
And our music.
And it's doing very well. I mean, I can say this, you can't, but the show is doing very well. And we're so grateful to our listeners for that. Well, before we finish up, anything else that you want to say this January, these special episodes to our listeners?
Well, I think there's only really one thing that I can say, which is that I'm sending everyone so much love and really wishing that this is the year that people feel that they can reinvent themselves.
Absolutely. And I would just say from the limited relationship that I've had with you over these past 2 years, it is absolutely possible, people. Take her word for it and embrace these teachings. It'll change your life. Well, that's all for this episode of Reinvent Yourself with Dr. Tara. Remember, No matter your mindset or your stage in life, any brain, even your brain, can change. Even you can reinvent yourself. Here with Dr. Tara, I'm Mark Steele, and we will see you next time.
I know now that I can carry on. I know I will see your face again. There's never been another soul to save me.
If you have a question or a comment for Dr. Tara, email or send an audio recording of your question to Dr. Tara at knox.studio. Dr. Tara's latest book, The Source, is available wherever books are sold. This has been Reinvent Yourself with Dr. Tara, a Knox Studios podcast. All rights 2023 Knox Studios. Produced by Mark Steele, Nadir Tavangar, Shahada Kari, and Jason Bashour. Written by Dr. Tara Swart-Bieber and Mark Steele. Engineered and sound designed by Knox Studios. Original music composed and produced by Sundry Souls.